developments.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for the explanation of my impossible task. Well, of course, thank you very much for the invitation. I've spent a couple of nice days here, away from the winter in Princeton, so that has been very nice. And of course, I have the risk of not satisfying any of the two groups here. Hopefully, I won't get there, right? So let's give it a try. Okay, so this is the title of my talk. And I chose this topic because I think it's one of the topics where mathematics and physics, thank you, have a very nice connection, which is very beautiful. And since I was a student, an undergraduate, I was very attracted to precisely this connection between the two things, between differential geometry and gauge theories. So I'm going to talk about some connections in algebraic geometry, but I learned that a little bit later on. Okay. So first of all, I would like to give you an introduction of why we do physics. Our best model that we have nowadays, which is a standard model of particle physics. I'll tell you the building blocks. I'll explain a little bit of the building blocks of a standard model, which are gauge theories, how they arise in physics, some of the hard problems that we have in physics nowadays, and some attempts to their solution. And one of them, which has been a very remarkable theoretical attempt, which is supersymmetry. Then I will move on to gauge theories and geometry, where I will establish this map that I found when I was a graduate student. I found in the books, of course. It's not that I discovered it, but I found it in the book. And since then, it caught my attention. And then we will move on to several examples of this relation between gauge theories and geometry, different kind of geometries, starting with a recent proposal of Witten, where you have n equal to 4 superjump mills, which turns out to be related to certain curves in CP3, okay, to certain algebraic curves in CP3. Then we will move to n equal to 2 Cyber-Witten theory, which is not very recent, so it doesn't fit my description of the title. However, it is going to lead us to some n equal to 1 deformations, where we're going to find a very, very precise mathematical problem in algebra, which is very hard to solve. Well, at least to me, it's very hard to solve. Maybe someone here can tell me the way of doing it. And I will explain to you how, using geometric engineering, we can translate that problem in algebra to a problem of simply, it's going to become a variational problem. I'm not going to tell you how to solve the variational problem, but I will give you a proof of the equivalence between the two problems. And you have to take my word that the variational problem is much simpler to solve than the algebraic problem. And then I'll conclude. Okay. So let's start with physics. So what do we know of nature? So particle physics, our best model is a standard model. We think that there are three interactions which we understand very well. Electromagnetism, where we have, for example, electrons and protons interacting and producing something that is very important for us, which is a bound state known as hydrogen. So we know that this is a very important bound state for us, and the responsible for it is electromagnetism. We have the weak force, which is perhaps the less known of the forces, because it's but we know, we are very familiar with something that comes out of the weak force, which is radioactivity. One example, when you have a nucleus that decays into another nucleus, essentially that comes from a very simple process, which is a neutron decaying into a proton plus an electron plus something which we call antineutrino. Okay, so these are just different particles. And we have the strong force, which is also very important for us because it's responsible for the binding of protons and neutrons in the nucleus. Without a strong force, the nucleus will be just be unstable, and we will not be here. I will not be here giving this seminar, at least. And finally, we have gravity. Well, you see that gravity is on a different color here. That means that it doesn't belong to the standard model yet. Hopefully, at some point, we will have a standard model which also includes gravity. Now, gauge theories are the building blocks of the standard model. So now we understand that electromagnetism and the weak force combine into a nice object, which is an SU2 weak times a U1, which is called hypercharge. They combine into this gauge theory, where the electromagnetism is just a subgroup here. Okay, we have QCD, the theory of strong interactions. We believe that this is the correct theory of strong interactions, and it's based on a gauge theory with gauge group SU3. And finally, in red, again, we have a string theory, which is our best candidate for describing gravity and all the other interactions in a unified framework. And again, as gravity, I hope that this will come someday part of our standard understanding of nature. Now, let me give you a very brief introduction of what we do in physics, or what we think are the basic interactions that are responsible for all we see around us. So let's start with a simple example, QED, quantum electrodynamics. It's a theory of photons and electrons. So photons are denoted by gamma, and electrons, they have this minus sign, which denotes the electric charge. Now, our basic understanding is the following. We have photons and electrons interacting, so you see the arrow of time here. So we have a photon and an electron coming together. They do something, they interact in a very complicated way, and then they come out. So our goal is to understand what happens in that bubble, what happens in that complicated process. The way to do it, of course, is to divide that process in simple processes. And the first step is to think that this electron interacts with the photon, continues as an electron, and then the electron emits the photon again, and it continues as an electron. So this is what we call an interaction vertex in physics, and this is a building block of all interactions in QED. So the rule is try to draw all the possible interactions that have that building block. So you come to the next step, where you can think that this electron, before becoming another photon, before emitting a photon, emits a photon here that is later on absorbed by the same electron. Now, each interaction vertex comes with a strength for that interaction, which is the electric charge. So we have the strength of the electromagnetic interaction is measured by this fine structure constant, which I've given there. And it's very small. It's much smaller than 1. Therefore, this expansion that I've given to you makes sense. So we can do this asymptotic expansion and compute this process. This is called perturbation theory. So perturbation theory is a very good tool for QED. Note that I haven't given you any example where the photon interacts with itself, with another photon. So that doesn't happen in QED. And that's the reason why the theory is very simple. Or at least simpler than its relative QCD. So in QCD, we have gluons and quarks. Gluons are the analog of photons, and quarks, the analog of electrons. And they carry color charge. Now, so we have a quark with one color, interacts with a gluon that has two colors, and it becomes a quark with another color. Of course, the meaning of color here is not what we usually refer to as colors. But the new thing here is that this interaction vertex, which is the same that we had in QED, it's not the whole story. We also have to add interactions between different gluons of this form. and also of this form. I didn't draw the colors here because it would have been very complicated. So we have to keep in mind that we have these new interactions, and the strength of the interaction is of order 1. So our perturbation expansion is not valid anymore, so we are out of luck. We are in the non-perturbative regime. And this leads to one of the outstanding problems in physics, which is the observation that the color charge is confined, meaning that all we see in nature are packages that don't carry color charge. One of such packages is a proton, for example, which has 3 quarks of the kind UUD. So these are, it's not very important what UUD is. And these are called baryons. Now, you see that in red, you can see the gluons. They interact with themselves, and they produce this very complicated net of interactions. And if you try to pull out one of those quarks out of the proton, what is going to happen is that after you pull it out, you have given to the system enough energy in such a way that another quark and something that is called an anti-quark can pop out of the vacuum and produce another baryon plus something that we call a meson. So one outstanding problem in physics is understanding why this happens and computing the spectrum of baryons and mesons, compute their mass, but we are not there yet. We don't know how to do it, explicitly at least. So we have some attempts. Of course, we have to do something. And one of the very successful attempts is numerical simulations. You try to, if you are not able to do this analytically, you simply do it using computers. And this is called lattice QCD. They have been able to compute the spectrum of some in some regime of baryons, and they can predict them, their masses up to 10% of accuracy, sometimes even better. So they are doing very well there. But in my opinion, I would like to do much better than that. I would like to get a handle analytically over the problem. So another attempt is to take the number of colors very large, okay? This is an attempt by Truff, which I'm not going to use very much in this talk, so I'm not going to describe it here. But I'm going to describe something that I'm going to use, and it's the following. We don't know how to solve the original problem, but suppose that we add some matter, matter meaning we add more quarks, more electrons, and so on, and we add new interactions among themselves in such a way that the problem becomes more symmetric. It has more symmetries. And we all know that when you have more symmetries, the problem sometimes is easier to solve. And one such symmetry is supersymmetry. And the way to get it is the following. We have n equals 1 supersymmetry, where you have the theory just with gluons. And you turn the quark, which carry only one color line, into something that carries 2 color lines. And we call it a gaijin. Given that there is a symmetry that relates these two guys, we call it supersymmetry. And we will put all these guys into something that we call a superfield, which we call it W alpha. The meaning of this alpha will become clear later on. So we are not happy with this. We can create things that are more symmetric by adding more matter and more interactions. So we have one of these guys, and we add some scalar fields plus still some more electrons or fermions. And we build another superfield phi. This theory is more symmetric than this one. And we can even go to n equals 4, where we have 3 of these guys and 1 of these guys. So these are the 3 theories that we would like to consider today. But before we do that, let's define gauge theories the way we do it in physics and the way we would do it in mathematics. So first of all, in physics, we have a gauge group G, which is U1 for QED, which is abelian, and SUM for QCD, or its generalizations, right? And in mathematics, we think about G simply as a structure group of a given bundle over R4. We can think about that as a principal bundle. The gauge field in physics, we think about it, as a vector that has as an m by m matrix of vectors, okay, where the m by m matrices lie in the Lie algebra of the group. In geometry, this is a natural object, which is the connection, which is a Lie algebra value one form, okay. The next object is a field strength, which is constructed in this way for U1, and in this way for SUN. These Fs are the structure constants of the gauge group. In geometry, this is nothing but the curvature 2 form, where F is constructed from the connection in this way, in the abelian case, and in the non-abelian case in this form. The other fundamental object in physics is the axiom, which is given by this. And in geometry, this is just a pairing, the natural pairing of 2 forms using the Hodge dual star. Okay? And any matter field in some representation becomes in geometry just a section of a given bundle. Okay? All right. So we are ready to do to study some particular problem. And we will start with the n equal to 4 super jump. We would like to understand, you might think that this is a little bit strange because I was introducing all these symmetries to understand non-perturbative results, and now I come to you and tell you that we will try to use n equals 4, and we would like to understand perturbative results there. Well, you will see why. In physics, we describe the process by computing something that is called the scattering amplitude, whose square, or the magnitude of that quantity square, is equal to the probability for this process to happen. Now, in this theory, we have our gluons, okay, and they satisfy, classically, nonlinear equations, which are the Jahn-Mills equations. Now, we can linearize them and think about the gauge field as a superposition of polarization vectors with the solution to the plane wave equations. I've described this to you because I want to introduce something that we call in physics the momentum that enters in this solution to the plane waves. And this solution that is called the plane wave solution. These coefficients, upon quantization, will be the ones that acting on a vacuum will produce our Hilbert space, which will give the quantization of our theory, and it will produce the particles that I've drawn as lines here, which are going to be our gluons. Now, each gluon is described by its momentum, by the helicity vector, and by the given color structure that it has. It turns out that we can trade the information of the polarization vector for something that is called the helicity, which is only plus or minus. So what is a helicity? In mathematical terms, there is a simple definition of it. We can think about solutions to the linearized equations that are dual or anti-self-dual, okay, whose field strength is dual or anti-self-dual. So remember that the Hodge star in Lorentzian signature, the square is minus 1. So we have either satisfying this or this equation. So that's what we mean by plus or minus. Now, the scattering amplitude for n gluons is a function of the momenta of each of the gluons, of the momentum of each of the gluons, the helicity, and the color structure. It turns out that there is a way of expanding these amplitudes in such a way that the color structure, or the group structure, can be pulled out of the amplitude, and we are left with something that depends on only the momentum and the helicity. This is oversimplified because there are more complicated structures involving several traces over the Lie group matrices. But this is enough for our purposes now. Okay? So consider the Lorentz group. We are always working on R3,1. So the Lorentz group is SO3,1, right? Consider the complexification of the Lorentz group. It goes to SO4,C. This is isomorphic to SL2 cross SL2. Therefore, any representation of SO3,1 in the complexified version falls into just the direct sum of representations of this SL2 and this SL2. In particular, the vector representation can be written as a sum of two contributions coming each from one fundamental representation of this SL2, and this other object transforms in the fundamental representation of this other SL2 group. If the vector is Lie-like, this piece is not here if p squared is 0. This is what we call Lie-like vector. Okay? So why did I choose, or why do we have to work with n equals 4 supersymmetry? Well, the reason is that the theory is conformal invariant. Okay? Conformal invariant means that is symmetric, that is invariant under a larger group, not only SO3,1, but SO4,2. Upon complexification, it becomes SL4. Now the generators on this acting on these scattering amplitudes, they have a very, very strange representation, which is given by these formulas here. So we have the generators of translations, which are the product of these two spinners, the generator of special conformal transformations, which acts as a second-order differential operator, and the dilatations as a first-order differential operator. But this is very unnatural. We will like a realization of the conformal group, which is more transparent. And the way to do it is just by Fourier transforming these variables, or replacing these variables by the derivative with respect to the conjugate variable upon Fourier transform. Okay? Once you do that, the generators, all of them become linear differential operators, which is precisely what we would like to get. Now, each gluon, each momenta, instead of being described by lambda, lambda tilde, it will have to be described by lambda and mu, where mu is a new variable. And this forms a vector in C4, and SL4 acts naturally on this. This is what is called the twister space. But it turns out that multiplication by t leaves this guy is invariant, where t is a non-zero complex number. So this is most naturally described in the projectivization of C4, which is CP3. Now let me describe to you the conjecture of Witten. He conjectured that these amplitudes for n gluons, remember that now all we have to do is to describe how many gluons have positive or negative helicity, okay? So if you have an amplitude with m negative helicity gluons and any number of classes, we can do a perturbative expansion. Remember, one of the first transparencies, we have a perturbative expansion in terms of processes that involve a graph that doesn't contain any loops. So this is what we call a three-level graph. Here we have something that contains one closed loop, and here we have something that contains two closed loops. So the conjecture is the following. Once you take the Fourier transform of the amplitude, meaning that you take the Fourier transform with respect to the lambda tilde variables, with respect to the variables that transform under the fundamental of the second SL2, this new object vanishes unless each of the points is localized on a degree n minus 1 plus L, where L is the number of loops, and genus L curve in CP3. Well, of course, we need n copies of CP3 because we have n particles. Let me give you some examples, just to give you a flavor of the conjecture. So for L equal to 0 at 3 level, the degree has to be n minus 1, where m is the number of minus signs. So for m equal to 0, we only have plus signs. The degree of the curve in CP3 is minus 1. But we all know that there are no degree minus 1 curves in CP3. So the amplitude has to be 0. Indeed, this amplitude can be shown to be 0 by explicit computation or using some symmetries. For m equals 1, we have 1 minus only, and we have degree 0. And a degree 0 curve is a point in CP3. Now, a point means that all the coordinates of the particles are proportional to each other. This means that all the momenta are collinear. So all the possible Lorentz invariants that can enter in the amplitude will be actually 0. And that can only be if all the momenta are 0. And this will give also that the amplitude is 0, except for 3 gluons, which is a very subtle case. And I will not treat it here. But for any number of gluons that is larger than 3, we have 0. Let me describe what happens for 2 minuses. Okay. So don't worry, we will get only to 10 minuses. No, we will get only to 4 minuses. Okay. So for 2 minuses, we have degree 1. So a degree 1 curve can only be a line. And let me call Zi the coordinates of a given point in this CP3, okay? So if the points are on a line, that's what we say, that the points are collinear. And that happens if and only if the coordinates satisfy this relation, where A, B, and C are the coordinates of the 3 points that we want to check that they are collinear. Now, it's possible to take these amplitudes, the explicit amplitudes that people have computed, and do the Fourier transform. But I don't want to do that, because for more minuses, that won't be possible. So what I want to do is to show to you how to translate this algebraic condition into a differential equation. And the way to do it is by simply saying, well, we will construct this differential operator coming from here by replacing each coordinate by its value, except for the mu's, which we will replace them by derivatives with respect to lambda tildes. So we get from this formula this expression plus all cyclic permutations of A, B, and C. So if an amplitude upon Fourier transform has all these points lying on a line, it should be annihilated by this operator. And indeed, if you take the amplitude has a piece that I didn't mention up to now, but is always there. It's a delta function of the momenta, which only means that the sum of all the momenta of the particles coming in plus the particles coming out has to add up to 0. So this operator, it's not difficult to show that it annihilates the delta function. So it has to annihilate the amplitude. And it turns out that people have been able to compute these amplitudes explicitly for any number of pluses. And they only depend on lambda. They don't depend on lambda tilde. And this was conjectured by Park and Taylor, and later on proved that the amplitudes only depend on lambda. and therefore they are trivially annihilated by these collinear operators. So this also works. Let's go to m equal to 3. Here we have a degree 2 curve, which is a plane conic. We construct the plane conic as the zero locus of these two, this degree 1 and this degree 2 polynomials in CP3. So we can use this linear polynomial, this linear function, to solve for one of the C's, plug it here, and we get this quadratic equation in CP2, which has to be satisfied by all the points in our amplitude. So clearly, if you have less than 5 points, this is trivially satisfied, right? You can always find coefficients Cij's in such a way that you can solve these 5 linear equations, okay? So there is no constraint from this equation for 5 or less gluons. But if you have 6 gluons or more, let me show you again the equation. You have to solve 6 linear equations, okay? And this will have a non-zero solution only if the determinant of this matrix vanishes. Okay? Well, the determinant of this matrix, remember that whenever we have coordinates coming from mu, we have to translate them into a differential operator. So the determinant of this matrix, once you use the Fourier transform, becomes a differential operator of a very, very high degree. So it's very non-trivial that this differential operator will do anything to the amplitude. In particular, that it's going to annihilate the amplitude. It turns out that it does. So these are some of the cases that has been checked. So if you have an amplitude with 3 minuses and 3 pluses, we have been able to check that it's actually annihilated. 4 pluses is also 0. And we have a conjecture for how to write the amplitude in general in such a way that you can see that it's annihilated by this operator just by inspection. You don't even have to take the derivatives. But I won't have time to describe the conjecture for these amplitudes. But in any case, it's a conjecture. And finally, let's describe the case with 4 minuses. This is a degree 3 curve. So this is a twisted cubic. This is the first case when you have a curve that doesn't lie on a CP2. So you are really testing the CP3 structure of these amplitudes. Well, it turns out that whenever you have 6 points in generic positions, meaning that no 3 of them are collinear or no 4 of them are coplanar, they lie on a twisted cubic. So for 6 points, you don't have anything to say. It's like when you have 2 points, they always lie on a line. So here you have 6 points, they always lie on a twisted cubic. So you have to go to the 7-point amplitude to test the conjecture. Now you have 2 problems. The 7 gluon amplitude is a very incredible, complicated object. And second, how to test that the object lies on a twisted cubic, that the 7 points lie on a twisted cubic. And there is a very nice trick in algebraic geometry, which is called the Gell transform. And it's the following. If you have 7 points in CP3, using SL4 invariants, you can set the coordinates. Let's put the points, the coordinates of the points as the rows of this matrix. So using SL4, we can set the coordinate, the first 4, to have this structure to form the unit matrix. And we have the remaining 3. Now the Gell transform takes these 7 points to these other 7 points, where you take B transpose and this identity 3 by 3. And now these 7 points are thought of as lying in CP2, not CP3. And it turns out that 7 points in CP3 lie on a twisted cubic if and only if their Gell transform, so the new 7 points we have constructed in CP2, lie on a plane conic. So all you have to do is to use the same trick that you had for the plane conic, construct the differential operator, and then try to go ahead and add with this horrible differential operator on this big, big amplitude and see if you get zero. Indeed, you do get zero. Okay. So this is a very non-trivial check of the conjecture. And as I promised, I was going to stop at m equals 4, okay? And the reason is that we haven't been able to go to more minuses. That's good for you, otherwise. Okay, so that's enough of n equals 4 super jamials. So with n equals 4, I just wanted to show to you the relation between some tools in algebraic geometry and how we can use them to constrain some of the amplitudes. Actually, in the title, in the abstract of my talk, I said that I was going to talk about the computation of these amplitudes. It turns out that actually computing the amplitude, these are only constraints on the amplitude. Actually computing the amplitude is a very, very complicated matter. So some people here at the KITP have been able to actually compute some of the amplitudes from string theory. But that would take me too far. And it's still not clear how to use that efficiently to compute them. So I think I'll wait until we learn how to compute them efficiently, and then I can tell you. Instead of doing that then, I decided to look at a different theory, an n equal to 2 theory. This is an n equal to 2 theory with gauge group SUN. This is a very old and standard theory now. Well, all according to my standards. This theory was solved by Cyber and Witten, meaning that it's possible to understand the physics at very low energies and what happens to the spectrum and everything. So let me describe that a little bit in more detail. So we have our field W alpha. Now you know what alpha means, right? It's the index under one of the SL2s that I was describing before. Okay, so in this case, it's the SL2 right. So we also have the complex conjugate of this field, which transforms under the other SU2. And we have the field, the superfield phi, which has a scalar field and a fermion. It turns out that this theory also contains a potential for phi. So this potential constrains phi classically to be a diagonal matrix, okay? So classically, we can describe the space of stationary points, or what we call the moduli space of vacua, as just several copies, as a copy of Cn, spanned by these coordinates, which are the Casimirs of the gauge group Sun. So given some values of ULs, we have a point in the Coulomb branch. This is what we call the Coulomb branch. And at a generic point, the gauge group is broken to U1 to the M minus 1. So from SUN, we went to UM minus 1. Classically, at some points, when some of the eigenvalues coincide, you get an enhanced gauge symmetry. But this is not going to be so in the quantum theory. And from the N equal to 2 supersymmetry, after you include all the quantum corrections, the final, all the physics can be extracted from a single function f that depends on m minus 1 fields, which are essentially the superfields transforming under these U1s. So all I want to say is that all the physics that we have in this n equal to 2 theory is encoded in a hyperelliptic Riemann surface, even here, defined by this equation, where p is a polynomial of degree n, and lambda is some parameter that came out of the blue. We didn't have any lambdas in our original theory, but this only reflects the fact that the theory is not conformal invariant anymore. So we have a new scale in the theory, which we call it lambda. Now, Pn is this polynomial defined in terms of the Casimirs of Un, of Sun, in this way. So you just expand the determinant of this matrix. This is an example of the first few terms. So you get that all the coefficients are determined in terms of these ULs. So a choice of ULs will give you a point in the moduli space of these Riemann surfaces. So you will have a particular Riemann surface for a given point in the moduli space. Now, all the physics information, that is, for example, the masses of all the electric objects and the magnetic objects, are given in terms of the periods of the Seibert-Witten differential, which is nothing but this metamorphic one form constructed out of P and Y and X, integrated over the A cycles, and the magnetic objects are coming from the dual cycles, where I have to make some choice of the canonical cycles for the Riemann surface. Now, Seibert and Witten found that after you do this, this function f that determines everything is just given by solving this equation. So as simple as that, all the physics is just encoded there. Another piece of information in physics is given by the coupling of these U1s. So you can have these U1 theories, they can couple to each other. And it turns out that the matrix of couplings of these U1s is nothing but the period matrix of the Riemann surface. Okay, so this was the old story. And I told you that I was going to describe that in order to bring us to something more recent, which is the n equal to 1 theory. This is not n equals 1 theory. This is something that comes from the n equal to 2 that we were describing before. But we will introduce a deformation to the theory. Parametrized by this polynomial of degree n plus 1. So I want you to keep in mind this polynomial of degree n plus 1 because we will use it several times, but perhaps not this one in particular. I would like you to remember the function that describes its stationary points, meaning the derivative of that polynomial with respect to x, and we will call the stationary points ai. Now, the field phi classically can have as eigenvalues only the solutions to this equation, because that's precisely the way we introduce the deformation, in such a way that all the other possibilities are ruled out. So these are the only ones that we have. And naively, once you try to look at the theory in the infrared, there is no way you can find a stationary point of the full effect of the full superpotential in such a way that the vacuum energy is going to be zero. So naively, you will get that there are no supersymmetric vacua in the theory. And this is not so because Seibert and Witten also found that the story is more beautiful than that. There are massless monopoles in the n equal to 2 theory at some points in the Coulomb moduli space. Close to those points, you have to include the massless monopoles in the whole Lagrangian. And the variation of that Lagrangian produces what is called the Seibert-Witten equations, which have a very deep relation to the Donaldson theory of invariance of four manifolds. But I'm not going to talk about that. Rather, I would like to describe a different problem, which is to find the value of these Casimirs. I told you that you have the full Coulomb moduli space of vacua described by the values of these Casimirs. And I would like to find the particular points where supersymmetry is still preserved. Okay? How can I do that? Well, a clue comes from the fact that classically Un is broken to this product of Unis, where if you notice phi has ni eigenvalues precisely of the kind of ai. So in the infrared, in physics, we know that this u1, this each of these un's splits into a u1 times suni. This suni confines, by the mechanism that I was describing at the beginning of the of the talk. So this SUNI confines, and the only degrees of freedoms that we have at the end of the day are these photons, these U1s. But if you remember, for the original n equal to 2 theory, we had U1 to the n, capital N. So this is a subgroup of this. So somehow, n minus n of them have disappeared. So how come that they have disappeared? The reason they have disappeared is very easy to understand. All you have to realize is that at the points where you have a magnetic monopole, you have to use a dual description, which is nothing but an SP2M, Z transformation on the Riemann surface in such a way that the monopoles will become electrically charged under these U1s. Now, the interaction of these two produces something that is called the Higgs mechanism, where M, the solution of M at the minimum of the equations, is non-zero. And that breaks these U1s. So that makes these U1s disappear, and that's precisely what we wanted. Therefore, confinement in the electric theory, which was the original theory that we were describing, can be understood as a condensation of these magnetic monopoles, meaning that the monopoles at the solution of the field equations have a non-zero value, are equivalent to each other. Of course, we would like to do the same thing for QCD, but we are far from there. So we are ready to present the mathematical problem. So this is where I might need some help. If someone knows how to solve it, I'll be happy to hear it. The mathematical problem is the following. We want to find the points in the Coulomb modulus space where you have some number of magnetic monopoles. How many of them? Capital M minus N. What do we mean by having massless magnetic monopoles? It means that the Riemann surface has to degenerate. N minus N of the cycles of the ace of the dual cycles have to pinch to zero size. So that means that the Riemann surface, which was originally given by this, has to degenerate by having N minus N double roots. So the problem is to find, well, given W prime, so you know all the AIs and GM plus 1, so you know these values. Given those values, find this polynomial of degree N such that this equation is satisfied, where F to N, well, this problem has a, is the solution is not unique. It has a small n dimensional subspace of space of solutions. But the solution is can be fit uniquely if you also impose a constraint that F has to be written in this form. So you have to find F, H, and P in such a way that this equation is satisfied once you know W. Just to give you a flavor of what the solution should look like, let me tell you the explicit solution of this problem for n equal 1. So for n equal 1, W prime is just a linear polynomial. Let's choose it to be x. It turns out that the solution is the following. F of x is just a constant, is given by minus 1. Therefore, this is the equation that we have. And Pn is given by the first Chebyshev polynomial, Chebyshev polynomials of the first kind, which are defined in this way. Or if you wish, they are also defined as the cosine of n theta, where x is defined as cosine of theta. So it turns out that if you span this, this is a polynomial of degree capital N. And H is defined to be the derivative of Tn with respect to x, and is known as a Cherychev polynomial of second kind. And this precisely is the solution that we were looking for n equals 1. Well, we don't know the solution for any n larger than 1. And at least to me, the problem is very hard. So now I would like to describe the way to translate this problem into a variational problem. And this is done using something that is called geometric engineering in physics. I'll just give you a glimpse of what it means, geometric engineering, but I won't try to explain it in detail. So we use a string theory, which is a theory defined in 10 dimensions, and we usually write it, we usually decompose the 10 dimensions in terms of R3, 1, our space-time, and a six-dimensional geometry, whose geometry and topology determines the physics of this three-dimensional of our space-time. Now we also have a string theory. It's not just a theory of strings. It also has deep brains, which are some submanifolds where these strings can end. But in mathematical terms, all we're doing in string theory is studying maps from Riemann surfaces into this space. Now we are also allowing maps of open Riemann surfaces where the boundaries have to lie on some submanifold. In the 10-dimensional space-time. Now, how do we get the n equal to 2 theory that we were discussing? Well, we take the six-dimensional manifold to be a cup, to be just a C-plane times something that is called an ALE space, which stands for asymptotically locally Euclidean space, which is nothing but the blow-up of C2 mod Z2, which is very easy to describe as this variety in C3, okay? Described by this equation. Now, the blow-up has a P1, which is the exceptional divisor, and we have these brains wrapping this S2. We have n of them in order to produce a UN theory, okay? Now, the n equal to 1 theory that we want to have, which is the one that has this problem in algebra, is a complex deformation of this space. We don't want to do the scalar deformation anymore, this blow up. We want to do a complex deformation. So we add this T here. Now we want to fiber this space over C, and T becomes a function on C, which is this C here, which I would like to call it X, the C plane, the coordinate on the C plane. And I will choose T to be precisely our old friend, W prime. Therefore, the equation becomes this equation here. This is a cartoon of what the manifold looks like. So we have the C-plane. Over each point, we have an S2. And precisely at the roots of this, the S2 collapses to a point. And the brains that we had split into stacks of ni brains wrapping one of these points. So I hope this was very obscure to most of you, because that was the intention.
What's the motivation for taking ALE space?
For taking an ALE space?
Yeah.
The idea is that you want to preserve n equal to 2 supersymmetry. If you take any space, any manifold, let's say any real manifold, you won't be able to define covariantly constant spinors, and then all the supersymmetry that you had or you want to preserve will be broken. So that's the reason why you want to consider only special class of manifolds, those for which you will have
But they are more general than some hot flat spaces.
That's right, yes. So these are precisely the ones that will give you the structure. If you choose a different manifold, you will have more structure in the field theory in 4 dimensions. So that's why this is called geometric engineering. You're looking for the six-dimensional manifold in such a way that you will produce only the field theory that you're looking for. You don't want to get more or less. You want to get precisely. You mean ALF?
Flat rather than ARE. that's not enough for a purpose?
No.
You don't have enough structure?
We don't have enough structure.
But you still have symmetry, right?
Yes. Yes.
So what structure don't you have?
Well, I guess I'll have to think carefully what's the structure that you don't have. So I think I'll discuss that later with you, I guess. Okay. So let's move on. So what does the manifold look like at each of these points? The manifold is singular at each of these points, so it looks like something that is called the conifold. It has this topology, which is just an S2 cross S3 fiber over a segment of a real line, roughly speaking, and is singular at this point. Now, we can render this space smooth by doing two different kinds of deformations. One is by giving some size to the S2, and the other one by giving some size to the S3. So the first one is a Keller deformation, and the second one is a complex deformation. And the spaces, more explicitly, as I told you, this is called the conifold. This space, after a Keller deformation, becomes an O-1 bundle over P1, and this space becomes the cotangent of S3. Now, after Maldacena's conjecture of the relation between ADS, some string theory on some space, and a superconformal field theory, we learned that if we have D brains wrapping some cycle, they can be trade off by what we call our fluxes. Okay? In mathematical terms, this is nothing but saying that here, we have our brains wrapping these S2s. After the conifold transition, they disappear, and they become, or they are replaced, by these fluxes, which is nothing but a tree form, a closed tree form, whose integral over the S3 is non-zero. Not only is non-zero, but it's an integer. Okay, an integer given precisely by the number of D brains that have disappeared. Okay. So this deformation is described by adding this polynomial of degree n minus 1 here. These manifolds come with a holomorphic tree form given by this expression here. And the claim is the following. Now we come to the variational problem. And the variational problem is the following. If you integrate this holomorphic tree form, which is unique for this manifold, so there is a unique holomorphic tree form, and you integrate that times this H that I was describing before over this space, which we'd like to call a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold, and you think about this as a function of the deformation parameters, then the stationary points of this function g gives the solution to the n equal to 1 problem that I told you before. So that's a claim that I would like to prove. But a preliminary observation is needed, and it's the following. This integral over the Calabi-Yau reduces to an integral over a Riemann surface. So this means that I only have 5 minutes. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have a preliminary observation. This integral reduces to an integral over just a Riemann surface where lambda came down from this holomorphic tree form to become a meromorphic one form on the Riemann surface given by this, and H becomes a closed one form on sigma. So this lambda, the meromorphic one form, tell us that we don't have to consider a closed Riemann surface. It's a Riemann surface with punctures. And the punctures are precisely the points where the poles of this form lambda are located. Okay? So we have our Riemann surface, we have the cycles and the dual cycles, and we have the two punctures. Okay? Now the integral over the Riemann surface can be written, okay, as the standard decomposition. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the standard decomposition here. Okay, in terms of an integral over A cycles and dual cycles of the two forms, H and lambda. Of course, both of them are not holomorphic, otherwise I will get zero. So that's not what I want. H is a general real closed one form on the Riemann surface. But given that I have a Riemann surface with a puncture, I also have to add this term, where this integration is from P1, one of the punctures, to the other puncture, P2. I told you that H has integer periods, so all these are integers. And now I'm ready to prove to you that the two problems are equivalent to each other. The proof is the following. Once you take the variation with respect to the deformation parameters, lambda, which was this meromorphic one form, once you vary lambda with respect to the deformation parameters, it becomes a basis for holomorphic one forms on the Riemann surface. Now, the field equations become this. This comes from this term, and this comes from this term. Okay? Now, at this point, these equations look very obscure and seems to have nothing to do with the algebraic, with the algebra problem that I told you before. But note the following. For any Riemann surface, we can define the Jacobian lattice, which is a lattice in Cm minus 1 given by the following basic vectors. You form a vector by integrating this form over the A1 cycle, okay? So you integrate all the bases of holomorphic one forms over the A1 cycle and you produce one vector in Cm minus 1. You do that for all the cycles, even the dual cycles, and you produce what is called the Jacobian lattice of the Riemann surface. Now, if you have a zero divisor in the Riemann surface, there is a natural map from the divisor that maps the divisor into the Jacobian lattice of the Riemann surface. The Jacobian lattice, the Jacobian variety, sorry, is defined as Cm minus 1 divided by the Jacobian lattice. So, if you have any divisor of degree 0, which is given by just a collection of points with some powers, the map to the Jacobian variety is given by this, where phi is a natural map from the Riemann surface itself to its Jacobian variety, which is defined in this way. Any point on the Riemann surface maps to the Jacobian variety through this kind of, through this operation. You simply take a reference point x0 and you integrate these bases of holomorphic one forms to a point, to the point x. Now it's clear that for a degree 0 divisor, this reference point is completely irrelevant. And now you can see that the field equations that I told you that were very obscure are nothing but, remember that we had on the left-hand side, we had this formula, which is nothing but the map of this divisor into the Jacobian variety. And on the right-hand side, we had just a combination of integers times these integrals over the A cycles and B cycles, which were precisely the basic vectors of the Jacobian lattice. Therefore, this is 0 modulo the Jacobian lattice. So we only have one more minute to go to say, by using Abel's theorem tells us that if you have a divisor of degree 0 on the Riemann surface, then, and the divisor maps to 0 in the modulo the Jacobian lattice, or it maps to 0 to the Jacobian variety, then there exists a meromorphic one form on the Riemann surface, f tilde, I will call it f tilde, the function, the meromorphic function, such that its divisor is precisely the one that you have. That the divisor is this only means that f tilde has a pole p1 of order n and a zero at p2 of order n. And it doesn't have poles or zeros anywhere else. Okay? That fits the form of f to be a polynomial of degree n plus the square root of pn squared plus 1. This ensures that it has precisely a pole at p1, which is located at infinity on the upper sheet, and p2 will have a zero, which is located on the lower sheet, is infinity on the lower sheet. But we have to ask for this function to lie on the Riemann surface that we had from the beginning. And this is true. This function is going to be a function well-defined on the Riemann surface, which is this, if and only if this polynomial is a factor of this polynomial. So we simply write that in words by saying, in equations, by saying that this polynomial is a factor of this, and we have to require that the extra structure doesn't introduce more cuts. And the only way to do that is by requiring these guys to be a perfect square, so to have only double points. Therefore, now you can recognize this as precisely the problem we were trying to solve before. This is a Cyber-Witten curve at the points when you have n minus m massless monopoles. So that's the end of the proof that the two problems are equivalent. And it's just lucky that I only have two conclusions, right? Essentially, the conclusions are the following. So gauge theories, I've shown to you just a sample of the relation that they establish between physics and mathematics. So by now, it's very clear that gauge theories are very useful, and vice versa, mathematics, these branches of mathematics are very useful for gauge theories. These are differential geometry, algebraic geometry, and topology. Okay, we have seen also some examples where we can use mathematics to understand the physics. But as I showed to you in the last example, we can also use physics to give a completely new formulation to a problem. It was a problem in algebra, which I still don't know how to solve. But I told you how to use physics to get a new perspective on the problem in something that I know how to do, because I can take derivatives and I can do a power expansion and get the solution to the original problem. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for a heroic effort at solving an impossible problem. Are there any questions? So I had one. So this equivalence that you describe at the end between the algebraic problem and this. So were you saying that that could be viewed as a consequence of this geometric
transition? Yes.
That on one side you have this algebraic formulation and the other side.
That's right. That's precisely correct. Yes. That's precisely. We have this dual theory in terms of these fluxes, and well, that these two theories are equivalent is a conjecture. So, but anyhow, we use a conjecture to get a statement that we could prove later on. So we could prove that the variational problem is equal to the problem in algebra, independently of how we got to the two problems. So we don't have to prove that the geometric transition actually gives you dual theories. So that's good in that sense.
In geometric engineering, you compactified on this six-dimensional piece, which was essentially copy of C and the Gucci handbook.
Yes.
So do you know what happens if you compactify the resolutions of higher cyclic groups? You also would have an explicit description of the region.
Yes. So you have a whole family of Ailey spaces, right? Mm-hmm. So That's a very good question. And the answer is that, oh, thanks. So the answer is that you're going to get something that we call in physics quiver theories, which means the following. You will have, so we know that these ALE spaces are simply constructed by taking C2 modulo some discrete group of SU2, right? So that these discrete groups magically match the Dynkin classification of Lie algebras, okay? So what we're going to get, for instance, for the D-type, is a gauge theory in four dimensions that contains UM1, UM2, and so on. But now we have fields that transform in the fundamental of this group and in the anti-fundamental of this group. So we can produce these more general theories, and this is something very interesting for us in physics, because you know the standard model has more than one group, right? So this is a first step in generalizing all the structure I told you for a single group. Now, there you can also have non-hyperelliptic Riemann surfaces. That's what is going to come for these theories. And the same thing happens. You can reduce a problem to an algebraic, to a problem in algebra of some factorization for this non-hyperelliptic Riemann surface. And you can go through the geometric transition and map that into a variational problem. So that's also possible.
So people have tried this for A2,
A3, yes.
And what about the other, like B and D?
Just the basics, like proving that the two things can be done. Right. Yes? Oh, well, maybe, so that means that I didn't explain myself very well. So what I said was that for n equals 4, we were my first motivation for introducing supersymmetry was to understand non-perturbative effects. So what I wanted to say was that it was a little bit strange from my motivation that I was going to study perturbative computations in n equals 4. But I decided to include that topic because of the beautiful relation with these algebraic curves. Not because I'm going to learn something about non-perturbative aspects of n equals 4. Oh, okay, so that's another question. Not at this moment. I wouldn't know how to do it.
Okay. Well, thanks, Freddie, for coming.